Welcome to the Grinders Table, the podcast where we sit with C-suite executives and founders who are taking their industry by storm to figure out how you can build an exceptional career and business. Together, we'll try to uncover how they have both defined the odds and what you can learn from their experience.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Grinders Table podcast. And as usual, I have an amazing person as our guest today. In my usual fashion, I'll allow him introduce himself because I do not like introducing people. I think people introduce themselves better as, Oswald, please introduce yourself.
Are you sure that people introduce themselves better?
Because that's what you want the world to know.
Yeah, I find sometimes that a lot of people tend to be shy. Like a lot of times when people introduce me, I tend to look around and go, who are they talking about? Anyway, my name is Oswald Osaritin Gobadia. I am a technology person. Does that say a lot? No, maybe not. I like to refer to myself as the digital evangelist now. I am the managing partner for a new firm called Digita, and I'm a art and technology enthusiast.
Wow. All those things in one. I know there's a backstory, so we're going to do the backstory first. How did you find yourself in this space? I know you worked in government, you worked in technology, you're an avid art lover. What's the backstory? What did you study in school? Did you, they say hindsight is 50-50, but many years ago, did you think that you would end up where you are today?
Is it a mishroad or is it kidnapping? I actually studied biology in the university. And I wanted to be a doctor. So the fact that I'm in technology is a grand case of misroad. You turned left in one place and found yourself somewhere else. But it's been an exciting journey so far, and I do not regret or miss any of the steps so far. And it's an ongoing journey, so we're enjoying it. I studied biology. I thought I was going to become a doctor, but I took a job in an investment bank, in the technology space in an investment bank, and I have not looked back since then. You know, I've enjoyed the journey so far. Somewhat self-taught, although I do have a master's in telecommunications and computer science. But a lot of it, you know, I always thought there was an era in tech. I mean, I think that era in tech is the same era in tech now because a lot of people are self-taught. You know, I think a lot of people are learning programming now by themselves. But back then, we were learning network engineering and things like that. We were more infrastructural by ourselves by reading all these big tech books. And that's how we got things done then. There was no learning on YouTube.
True. Very, very true. But I'm still curious. What was that point where you decided, hey man, this degree or this life in biology is not for me? Because I find that at every inflection point in everybody's life, there's that time you make those big decisions. And sometimes it comes from maybe fear of, or maybe the future doesn't look as bright as you thought. Sometimes it's just you're challenging yourself. For you, what was it?
So, you know, I really, really did enjoy my biology program. I had a lovely time with it. It's biology with some chemistry under it, minor in chemistry. You know, very, very nerdy type major where you're really, really, you know, there's a lot of reading, a lot of studying, a lot of practicals, a lot of, you know, lab work and stuff like that. And even to today, I tell people that some of my thought process around solving problems comes from a biology view. You know, like even recently, I've been talking about transformation versus evolution. And I can guarantee you 100% when I think of evolution, I'm thinking of evolution as in Darwinism. I'm thinking of evolution as in biology. And that's the approach I'm using to think of policy and how to address policy today. And even some of my approach to how I look at policy and how to organize people, a lot of it is really based on, you know, either biology or some kind of cellular or molecular type, you know, reaction, you know, chemistry. It's crazy. My mind actually goes to both of those things and I kind of play them together. And that's how I kind of, you know, check what I'm thinking, you know. So I think somewhere, I would say somewhere along the way, you know, I got a job on Wall Street, which was very, very attractive. That decision not to go back to biology, you know, I think it was, I guess, a young man's decision, right? So you found yourself doing something that also excited you when you thought only one thing can excite you. Right. So you thought only biology can excite you, but then you find yourself, you know, in the heart of Wall Street, you know, doing technology. And you found that also was very intriguing. So you just never look back. And plus, you know, must add that the pay was nothing to really play around with. So it was also very decent pay. So I think those elements was what kind of dragged me I won't say kicking and screaming. I think I was dragged. I was happily kidnapped to move from biology to another type of sciences that, you know, very much stimulated me, I should say.
You said something about excitement, and I remember having a conversation with somebody recently, and we're trying to talk about the African or Nigerian context, particularly of how people, you know, change careers. So for some people, there's so much excitement. For some people, it's about the money. What would you think helps you make a decision? Do you look at the money or the benefits, or do you look at that excitement and the experience that you're going to gain from making that life decision?
Oh, goodness. I am notoriously stupid when it comes to making decisions based on money. I think more of the value that's going to be created and the impact to, you know, this sounds very like, I'm pitching for a UN role or trying to, you know, become a priest in the Catholic Church. Of course, I'm a capitalist, right? I'm an entrepreneur and I'm out to create value, and with value comes money. But my initial drivers is not always the money. I mean, there's a different route to go for just the money. It's more so what value can be created. And, you know, on these ideals, you may lose money, and the actual, you know, the money side may come a little later. But, you know, the decisions, most of my decisions are driven by what value is going to be created. What's the impact going to be on myself and other people, is what really drives me.
Hmm. Talking about value, and I'm still going to connect this to the amazing work you did in, you know, facilitating the passing of the Startup Act in Nigeria. But most people would say, the assumption is if you work for government, sometimes you have to let go of some of your values. But I want to ask you, for you, what are your values? What are the things that actually keep you going? What are those things that, you know, you wake up in the morning and you know, I'm going to do this because these are the things that I believe in.
So, I think one of the things that is important is understanding why you do things, and also understanding things that you wouldn't do, right? And, you know, that sort of self-actualization comes over time. I recently had one of those moments where I was able to draw the dots across a number of things that I've done over time. And I find that, you know, one thing that's consistent is that I like change, right? I'm not the like kind of person who walks into a room and leaves that room the same. Right. So if I walk into a room, if people are sad, I would like to make everybody smile. You know, if I walk into a room and, you know, people, you know, think the room is blue, I may leave that room yellow. You know, it's always the idea of not leaving the room the exactly way you left it. Always make some sort of impact, right? Or some sort of mark. So I found out somewhere along the way that I like to transform things, right? As is one of my drivers. And you mentioned the government bit. You know, there's an article that I wrote called the Spiritual Algorithm. You know, there's certain tricks you cannot teach yourself because of the situation. You know, the whole thing of the what, you know, the why, what, and how. You know, when your why remains somewhat consistent, you know, it's very difficult for how you do things to just drastically change, because you're trying to build this certain, you know, this why that you know, the reason why you're there, the reason why you do things, the reason why you exist. So your values and morals, it takes, you know, I would say a great deal of temptation for your values to shift when you go into government or go into any of those kind of situations where you are you've been made charge of some resources of some sort. I think that that what tends to happen is that you will likely do what you've always done. Right. So if you're the kind of person who goes into a room and, you know, you turn on the lights, it's quite possible that if you go into new spaces, you're going to turn off the lights. But I agree that we're all human, that some degree of temptation may make you not turn on the lights. You walk in there and just say, it's already dark. Let it stay dark, you know, and you just do nothing about it.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I also was discussing with somebody, and we talked about how sometimes your value makes you act in different ways that go against the crowd, right? And then you stand out, and sometimes you stand out positively, sometimes you become the enemy. Now, in cases where I want to believe that your values made you become the enemy, right? This guy doesn't want us to do the things we want to do, or who is this guy? Why is he showing off? How do you manage those situations?
I think you just have to not care. Right. You know, as long as the problem is not about your reputation, as long as the issue is not real, I think you would have to some extent either manage it, as in, you know, trying to find a way to bring light to it. Because in light, you know, most of these things don't survive, right? So, you know, somebody says, you know, this person has done this and done that. Yeah. I'm also take the approach of just addressing it, right? Cause when you illuminate any situation, you know, most things that are rubbish don't tend to survive, the illumination of the situation. And in some instances, you know, you just keep doing what you're doing, and not be bothered by the, I guess, somewhat, you know, undefined, peer pressure, right? Because that's supposed to make you change next time. So it's a different kind of peer pressure. You know, last time I did the right thing and I was slapped around. Next time I'm not going to do the right things. I've only slapped around. So it's kind of peer pressure, a delayed peer pressure. So it's one of those things where you have to make a case by case basis of, do you address this or do you remove yourself from the situation?
Do you think you're confrontational?
I would say that I'm not one to let rubbish slide, right? Yeah, I would say the answer is yes. You know, I don't think I need to try to parse words to try to make it sound a bit different. I think when you believe on certain things happen in a certain way, you may have to fight to get those things to happen. So I've had several situations where I literally, you know, make a statement almost out loud, a proclamation that I am actually going to charge into the situation and correct it. It's almost in a warring type mentality. Of course, it's not physical because some of these things are just intellectual. Some of these things are about pace and precision. You know, how fast are you moving to solve the problem intellectually? And a lot of times you find that if you're moving at a certain pace and you're persistent, you're very precise in what you're doing and what you're saying, you know, people who dwell in rubbish cannot keep up. And that tends to seem confrontational, but you're just outpacing them. It's like saying somebody who runs faster than you is confrontational because they are passing you, right? It's not confrontational. They're just moving at a pace to solve the problem, and you just can't keep up because you're focused on the wrong things.
True. You know, talking about people that are maybe used to mediocrity or acting a certain way, and I think that you always say every time I've heard you speak, you know, collaborative efforts, you know, learning to form synergies and all. But in instances where you want to form, you know, you're trying to collaborate and everybody's not just thinking on your own frequency or everybody is just okay with the status quo, what do you do in those situations? Do you, you know, try to, again, brute force and push through, or do you then figure out other people that can help you get towards your goals?
I think for most parts, and, you know, as I heard you ask the question, I just realized that to some extent, you know, peer-to-peer collaboration driving is something we have to continue to test. What we do know works is that the idea of assumed power makes it easier to develop collaboration, right? So if you are, you know, for instance, an SA to the president or senior special assistant to the president, you know, pulling people together because you do have the power to invite people to show up, may be a little easier than if you're all peers, right? So that I do admit, you know, is a truth and is a fact. But I believe that one of the ways to approach collaboration is to bring an understanding as to how, you know, the actions that we intend to carry out are to everybody's benefits, and being able to explain the beneficial aspects of, you know, the actions we're about to carry, we intend to do, how it benefits everybody. I think if you're able to sell that message, then you may have some potential for collaborative, you know, endeavor. What I find is that, you know, one of the most difficult things to do in Nigeria is, you know, we neither boil over nor do we comply easily. So what you'll find is that there's no real boiling point to some extent, and neither do we comply. So you just find that there's a middle ground where we're neither moving forward nor moving backwards. We're just spinning. And, you know, that dizzy feeling is what you feel sometimes when you're just like, what is this? You know, so if we can't force people to boil over and just say, look, this is enough, or you can't, you know, get people to comply and say, okay, I will just follow. It makes collaboration very difficult. But I think as we continue to drive home that, you know, these things are to our best combined benefit, then maybe people will see truth in it. You know, so, you know, I'll give you an example. And I just had this conversation today. When you think about the addressable market for Nigerian digital solutions, you know, when do we start collaborating on policy? Or should I just say, when do we start collaborating on the environmentals that makes it possible for us to sell, right? Because you have a case where, you know, on the policy side, we lack collaboration, as I've been heard saying many times. I think you heard me say it recently, or maybe I didn't actually. I think I didn't say this at the last event that I went to, but, you know, you have a lack of collaboration, within the public sector. You have a lack of collaboration within the private sector. And then to top it off, you have a lack of collaboration between the private sector and the public sector. You know, so that just creates an environment where it's very difficult to do very simple things. But then when you take that to an addressable market type situation, when do we start investing collaboratively to create the environment in which we can actually all benefit from, right? So you have low digital literacy, you have low digital inclusion. So what is the market size, right? What is the market size? Who has phones and understands how to use it? So you find that a lot of the startups are targeting the same. I don't want to throw a number out there because we don't really have data to support it, but it's not 200 million people that's the market, right? The market is probably a tenth of that, which means that any of these African countries, if they take their initiatives and collaborative approach quite seriously, they can easily outpace Nigeria. You know, if the country is 40 million people and they can expand their market to 20 million people, what have they done? You know, they've already surpassed the 10th, right? So those are some of the things we have to think about, the risk of not collaborating.
True, very true. Thanks for sharing. I mean, you've had so many wins, and that your life is actually very interesting when you talk about it, and when we get to meet sometimes in person and you chase. But also in between all your wins, you probably had some losses or some failures. Are you open to one that, you know, hit you hard or maybe kind of recalibrated the way you saw life?
Man. Anybody who does business in Nigeria, open care is a day-to-day thing. You have one on Tuesday and then you have one on Wednesday, right? It becomes a question of, you know, which ones are significant, you know. I mean, even in my book, you know, I have a book about entrepreneurship in pursuit, you know. I talk about my son, right? I have a son who was sick and I had to, you know, pack him up and fly out the country. I mean, that alone, you know, is shattering enough to have changed the direction of, you know, where I did business, how I did business, employee versus, you know, staff. And then you look at the impact of the continual devaluation of the naira. I mean, any businessman will tell you that if you close a contract at 100 and, you know, it shifts just a few basis points, you've reduced your margin, you know. So we're all getting poorer as we work very hard. It's not from a lack of getting, it's not from a lack of hard work, right? I had a conversation with an advisee today and I was just telling them, you know, over the last 15 years, this is how much I think I've made over the last 15 years. And then I said, you know, this is not, you know, on the year on year, this is not a lot of money, right? But it's a reflection of the market size, a reflection of the number of, you know, people in the markets, it's a reflection of the projects that are happening. It's a reflection of the devaluation of the currency, which you're doing business in. It's a number of things that, you know, that set you up to seemingly fail, maybe not outright fail, but, you know, you're just once again in that middle ground I explained earlier, you're spinning, you're not neither failing, not exactly, you know, really successful as you should be, as it relates to the effort. Then one of the things we all know and we don't talk enough about as entrepreneurs is that, you know, entrepreneurship makes you think you are alone, right? You literally go through this process where you think, FX have shifted, it's only me, right? But it's not true, right? So there are a lot of different issues that happen to you in the day-to-day business, day-to-day operations that you would think that is only happening to you, but is more so, you know, cross-board. The entrepreneur standing next to you is going through the exact same. And it's good to have those conversations. It's good to talk to other entrepreneurs. It's good to talk to a mentor and it's good to read books, because, business is actually a science and not an art form. And it's good to observe people who you believe are doing things right and try to see if their steps are repeatable. But But I would say that there's so many. I mean, this recent devaluation is painful. I mean, I've been joking with people recently. I was in the States, and every time I touched an item, you know, I did this math calculation and I put it back down. I'm like, I'm not buying this thing. And this is me before where, you know, I had weight problems. I had no weight problems traveling this time. My bags came nice and light because I did no purchasing. You know, so it's when you have that kind of issue happen, there's not too much other things that need to happen that would really derail you. We live in a constant state of things being, you know, volatile and being quite complex.
True. Very true. Talking about mentors and advice, what is one readily acceptable advice or popular advice that you think is wrong?
That I think is wrong.
Yeah.
I heard one the other day and I didn't note it. Okay. Being that I can't think of one and I don't want to leave the airwave quiet, I'll talk about the idea of mentors. Okay. I would say that one popular thing that is a big misconception about mentorship is that you could meet somebody and you like them and you go up to them and say, please be my mentor. You know, I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make. It's weird. I mean, every time somebody asks me, I'm sitting there going, I mean, you don't even know me. You know what I mean? You know, so in my book, Chuka Nye's book, we talk about the idea of North Stars and the idea of mentors. I think that I can easily serve as a North Star for a lot of people. Doesn't mean we should ever speak, right? It could be very well that you like my speaking cadence. It could be very well that you like the kind of shoes I wear. It could be very well you like how I approach a conversation or the points I make when I talk about a certain issue. You can take those points and use them, right? So that's sort of North Star. So there's certain people you follow. I have certain people that I look at. And every time they do something, I look at it. I study it. I say, okay. Look how they moved their hand and when they made that point. Fantastic. That's a North Star. That person doesn't ever need to be my mentor. Right? I like them for very specific things and I pay attention to them for very specific things. Then when you now develop a mentorship, you know, every time people talk, when they really talk about mentorship, they talk about mentorship relationship. In that situation, you know, you may find yourself that, you may find that you are doing more for your mentor than your mentor is doing for you. You know, it may very well be that you are serving your mentor. You know, you are doing things for your mentor. You are helping him out. You are thinking strategy for your mentor. You know, your mentor calls you and you talk through some stuff. But the day when you need your mentor to ask you for advice, that day is when they deliver the gold nuggets, you know. So it's not always the case where how we approach the mentor thing. I think a mentor thing is really about relationships because somebody who's giving you advice needs to actually know you, right? They need to know where you're trying to go, they need to know your desires, they need to know your issues. And some of those things are very personal. So I think sometimes, yeah, you can sit down with somebody, you know, you guys can sit there for coffee and you can just talk about to get business advice. But I think there's probably another level of just an advisor, somebody who's smart. You can ask the question, what do you think? Should I print business cards or shouldn't I print business cards? What are your thoughts on that? That's not a mentor. That's just somebody you're asking advice because they have experience, right? So I think, you know, we need to understand how to evaluate, the people who we bring into our lives under these titles. And make sure they're meaningful.
Absolutely. I also agree with that. Interestingly, there's something that, my partner always says that oftentimes when you get close to those supposed mentors, you realize that their life is not as great as you thought it was.
Oh, yeah. I recently said to somebody, I said, when you're looking at mentors and not stars, make sure they are doing, as in actually doing more than they are talking. So people sometimes pick mentors just by what they've read, what they've said, what their tweets. That's my mentor. But you've actually never seen them do. So there can't be two people talking. It's likely that space of talking has already been occupied. So you better be coming in to do. But you can't learn from somebody who has the talking business, right? So it's a very tricky thing. You need to ensure that you get to know the person you call a mentor.
Yeah. And in a world that is really driven by how well you can speak and show up, you know, at events or on social media, people get carried away quite a lot by that and not necessarily the substance in those people. It's been a really, really great conversation, Oswald. I really enjoyed myself, but I'm going to end with one question. And it's a question I like to ask everybody. So there's this framework, the power, money, fame, pleasure framework. I'd like you to rank them from top to bottom, which is more important to you and which is least important to you. I find that everybody has, oftentimes people have different perspectives on this.
Power, money, fame?
Fame and pleasure.
And pleasure. And you can only have, you just need to rank them. Not like you can have two out of the four or three out of the four.
You can rank them, which is more important to you, which is the least important.
So I recently told somebody that one of the interesting things about working in Abuja and the state government and the presidency is that feeling that you can actually make change, that you can actually have impact. Can you easily do that with money, or is it that you do that with power? Fame doesn't necessarily mean that you can do anything. It just means you're famous. Pleasure is your pleasure. You know, it's to yourself. And I guess if you come from that perspective, then you're basically processing everything through your pleasure. So definitely not pleasure. Pleasure and fame both take, you know, fourth place, you know, equal fourth place. I would say that you now start looking at money and power. Now, the reason why I don't just easily jump to power and still evaluating money is because I think in our environment, so that's one of the key things I tell people, you need to be talking about the environment you're in. I'm not in Silicon Valley. I'm not in New York. I'm in Lagos, right? I'm in Nigeria. I'm in between Lagos and Abuja. And evaluating the difference between money and power and money is very, very close. Can money get you power? Can money course and have the change that you want, and or can having power, and when you say power, you mean real power, right? Not just power. Real power to make change.
Yeah.
Okay. So if it's power, that the real power you're talking about, then I would say power is first, and then money is second, because real power can demand and control money. Real power can move money, and money can only beg power. Money can only seduce power, but cannot necessarily be guaranteed to move power. But real power can move money. So it's power, money, a space, big, huge space, then pleasure and fame.
All right. You guys, this has just been a great conversation. Also, thank you so much for spending the last 30 plus minutes with us. This has been enlightening.
No problem. I enjoyed myself.
That's all on today's episode of The Grinders Table, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at MonsieurUM. That's at Monsieur for Mr. in French, UM. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.